Hello and welcome to Time-Based Defenses Under E&O Policies, a webinar presented by Cozen O'Connor. The webinar will run for 60 minutes. Before we begin, we have a few housekeeping items to review with you. All participants are in a listen-only mode. This means you can hear the speakers, but no one is able to hear you. If you have any technical issues, you can send a chat message via the chat pod in the web room to tech support, or press star 0 on your telephone keypad if you're on the phone, or call the provider's help desk at 877-297-2901 for assistance. Also, the CE and CLE code will flash several times during the webcast. Please make sure you record the code on the form provided in the handout pod, which is located on the left-hand side of the screen. If time allows, we will have a question and answer session after the presentation. Please feel free to send your questions at any time during the webinar using the chat pod located in the lower left-hand corner of your screen and click on the send button. Today, our presenter from Cozen O'Connor's Global Insurance Department is Richard Mason, a member of the Philadelphia office. Rich Mason has been litigating professional liability insurance claims for nearly 25 years. He is co-chair of the firm's Professional Liability Practice Group. He is admitted in New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania and handles claims nationwide for leading insurers. I will now turn the presentation over to Richard Mason. Rich, please go ahead.
Good morning and welcome to Time-Based Defenses Under E&O Policies. I am as eager as always to pass along my experience in handling professional liability claims. I love teaching, so I'm very grateful to have such a large audience today. Briefly, I've been handling E&O claims for a quarter century, during the course of which much has changed. Early policies contained no definition of claim. They often lacked any retroactive date. And many courts were looking at them for the first time. Over the last 20 years, the law governing these policies has begun to mature and to provide crucial guidance for claims decisions. In this webinar, I'm going to address issues under claims-made policies that turn upon the timing of some event involving the insured or knowledge gained by the insured at a particular time. The issues that we're going to cover are, first, determining when a claim has been made; second, application of the retroactive date; third, application of extended reporting periods; fourth, the prior pending exclusion; and fifth, the prior knowledge exclusion. In each instance, determining the date when a relevant development occurred often is crucial to accurate claims adjudication. Some of these issues, however, are plagued by misconceptions and overstatements, which I will seek to correct. My aim is that you will hear at least five insights today that you haven't heard before. Now, each issue in our outline here concerns a separate, though potentially related, set of facts, as I will explain as we go further. Let's begin by looking at how we determine when the claim was first made. These are most of the issues that we look at. We look at whether the claim was first made during the policy period, whether it was timely reported, the retro date, and the prior pending and prior knowledge exclusion. The first thing that we examine is the policy's definition of claim. Now, when I first began working with these policies, many forms did not contain a definition of claim. Most current forms do, so we always begin by turning to the policy's definitions section. Even when claim is well defined, however, there are commonly recurring issues regarding whether there has been a claim. There's the policy's definition, if it has one. There is whether there has been a demand. There is whether there is at least a civil proceeding if there is not a written demand in the form of a letter, or administrative proceedings under most definitions, and there is the question whether the claim involves a covered wrongful act. Let's begin with the question of what is a demand in the sense of a claim under a claims-made policy. The concept of demand as defined or as interpreted by the court usually requires us to examine three particular questions. Has there been a written demand for money or services? Has it been received by the insured? And is it on account of a wrongful act by the insured? Now, the first point I want to teach you that you might not learn anywhere else is that except for the requirement of a demand, These elements are not universally required unless they are specified within the definition of claim in the policy. So it is sometimes assumed that an insured cannot possibly have had a claim against it if it has not received the demand or heard of it. This is true in many states, but courts in Oregon and California, for example, have said this is not necessarily so, and the vast majority of states have never ruled on the issue. The thoracic cardiovascular case from Arizona is illustrative of the minority but important view to know about. In that case, a former patient of the insured filed a malpractice action against the insured during the policy period, but did not serve the insured until 5 months after the policy was canceled. Prior to service, the insured was unaware the claim existed. The court held that under a claims made and reported policy, the insured takes the risk that it will not discover a claim against it in time to report it. Conceptually, this is quite logical. One's enemy might launch a vendetta, and it's still a vendetta even if you don't know about it. Therefore, some courts have reasoned that an aggrieved party can assert a claim against our insured without serving it on the insured. They've reasoned that the lack of service doesn't change that this party is seeking to recover from the insured. Now, of the small number of courts that have directly considered this question, the majority have concluded that the insured must know of the claim. But my point, similar to several I will make today, is not to assume that the law requires notice to the insured, because it might not. I recommend the same approach regarding the question of the extent to which the claim must expressly describe a wrongful act committed by the insured. That's when we look at the demand letter or the complaint and we look at the substance of it. As we'll discuss in more detail shortly, the claim must accuse the insured of having done something wrong. But relatively few courts have required the claimant's demand to reference a breach of the specific kinds of professional services covered by the policy unless the claim definition expressly requires it. Courts have recognized that it is a simple matter for an insured to submit a notice of circumstances in uncertain situations. So if the insured fails to do that, and it turns out that the demand would have triggered the policy, the court may conclude it should have been reported when first received. For example, the Lindsay versus Attorney Protection Society case decided last year very clearly stated that if the claim definition does not expressly mention that the claim must involve or cite to a wrongful act, then even a claim that omits specific mention of a breach of professional services needs to be reported at that time when it's received or coverage is lost. So already we've challenged two frequent assumptions, that a claim must be received and that it must refer to a wrongful act or it is not a claim. Both may be true, but only if the claim definition or the local law requires it. I was speaking with a claims examiner who had worked for 20 years on general liability claims and just moved into the professional liability context. Having been beaten up by courts in GL cases for 20 years, he was a habitual pessimist. But I told him, John, this is claims made. We win a lot of these cases. And we did. Sometimes, of course, the first demand the insured receives will be in the form of a complaint seeking damages, and usually one that's been filed in a court and duly served on the insured. In that instance, there's no question there is a demand. However, sometimes a complaint is received in more unusual circumstances. Many of you will be familiar with the receipt of a courtesy complaint, for example, which is provided by a potential plaintiff or an attorney for the plaintiff in advance of any formal filing in the court. And there are circumstances in which pleadings are not served but are filed with the court and the insured is provided a copy or learns about it. So if the complaint is served during the policy period, that usually presents little question that a demand has been made. And again, demand in almost every definition of claim is a core component. But sometimes a complaint is prepared against an insured and it's not filed or served, but although the insured is provided with or obtains a copy. In that situation, a court usually will conclude that a demand and thus a claim has still been made against the insured. The unfiled or unserved complaint is deemed to be the equivalent of a demand letter. The Ismailzadeh decision is instructive. That's cited at the bottom of this slide. The claimant provided the insured with a copy of the complaint seeking damages prior to the policy period. However, the insured resisted service. The process server knocked on the door and the insured wouldn't answer it. And they did that successfully until during the policy period when service was finally effectuated. The insurer then argued that the policy's claim definition dictated there's only a claim when a complaint is served on the insured. The court disagreed and held that when the insured was first informed of the complaint, the claim was made then and there. That's an important decision and some important reasoning. Now, claims arise most commonly in four different circumstances. We have written demands for monetary damages, and that frequently, but not always, is in the form of a demand letter, often from an attorney. A civil proceeding is your typical civil complaint filed in a court, but it may have a broader connotation. And if you have a worldwide policy, you may see a host of different forms in which pleadings may be filed. And we have arbitration proceedings and regulatory proceedings that may be included within your definition of claim, but may not be. So again, the first resort is to consult the definition. The first category here, a written demand, may embrace the latter three categories. However, I'll note that policyholders sometimes like to argue that a complaint that commences a civil proceeding, for example, is not the same thing as a written demand. They make this argument because many claim definitions expressly state that a civil complaint must be served on the insured for it to be a claim, while the same definition might not say this about a written demand. Thus, an unserved complaint, they argue, is not a claim. Civil arbitration and regulatory proceedings are all commenced in different ways, and it can be essential to develop some procedural expertise regarding these kinds of proceedings. Arbitrations may be commenced by service of a written arbitration demand, which comes in the form of a letter, and may appear relatively informal. Regulatory proceedings may be deemed to commence by a notice of charges or notice of hearing. I handled one case years ago where the proceeding was an Equal Employment Opportunity Commission proceeding. Prior to the policy period, the claimant filed charges with the EEOC. This is required under Title VII. The filed charge of discrimination was copied to the insured. The court held this charge, filed with the EEOC, was a claim because it was an administrative proceeding in which damages were being pursued. Other courts have disagreed, so this is an area of some contention in the law. Now, the existence of an initial filed pleading should always lead to the very reasonable and necessary question, was that complaint preceded by a written demand prior to the policy period? Many complaints do not simply appear out of the blue. For example, if a complaint alleged that the IRS imposed penalties in 2013, let's say, there's a good chance that the claimant taxpayer complained to her tax preparer a year or two earlier, since it takes about that long for the IRS to take a look at taxes and for an IRS penalty to gestate. So, if that tax preparer is the insured, then the insured very likely knew of the grievance against her prior to the policy period. So the basic historical truth is that demands often precede lawsuits, and they may come in many different forms, as we see on slide 7. Of these, in my experience, the trickiest claims often may arise when there's a grievance regarding services rendered, but no express claim for monetary recompense. Let's analyze a fictional example. We're looking at slide 8. This is a fictional letter that one might see. More and more we'll see it as an email. Now note, in this letter, there is no demand for a liquidated amount of damages. What I mean by that is there's no figure that says you owe me $1.6 million. So does it qualify as a demand and therefore a claim? Let's examine the letter for clues. I've highlighted in red the kinds of things that I would look at, although I'd look at the entire letter for context. We see, for example, that it's addressed to a lawyer within the legal department of the insured. It refers to a financial loss, and that's very important. So while the loss or the monetary amount here is not quantified, it very likely could be quantifiable, and that may be enough, and usually is, for this to be regarded as a demand. We see advice and advisor, which signals to us that professional services are at issue here, and we see a request for pecuniary loss and a desire to be made whole, which is a pretty close analogy to a claim for damages, and it has been served by an attorney. In my view, the clear majority of courts would regard a letter like this as very likely to be a demand, subject only to different policy language being applied. Let's compare this letter with a letter from someone who might be just as upset but have a different agenda. Now here, Ms. Virus is demanding that her agent do better. She is evidently not seeking compensation, and there's no evidence she's threatening to seek it, and that's important for purposes of our analysis. Her letter might be compared to a theater patron complaining about the show. The patron believes the show wasn't worth the money, but isn't demanding his money back. Aside from written demands, including civil complaints, some forms of claim include regulatory and administrative proceedings. Listed on slide 11 are some of the most common that we see. EEOC proceedings come up quite a bit, both under E&O and D&O policies. EPA actions, of course, are the bread and butter of claims-made policies issued under environmental impairment liability policies. Criminal investigations, more and more, particularly related to the securities area, affect the entire class of E&O policies potentially. And there are many other agency actions. The RSR case, cited in very small print at the bottom of page 11, is worthwhile reading. Here are the key facts in that case. The underlying action ultimately was a Superfund, a pollution cleanup action brought in the year 2000, seeking reimbursement from the insured for the government's cost of cleaning up waste sites the insured had owned. The insured sought coverage under an EIL policy that provided coverage for claims made during 1981 to 83, almost 20 years earlier. Now, the policy did not define claim. During the policy period, in other words, early 1983 in this case, sites owned by the insured had been listed by EPA on the National Priorities List, and the insured was notified of this and reported it to the EIL insurer. So that insured had a pretty alert and sophisticated risk management department. There wasn't much at that time for the insurer to do at that point, and so no action was taken. We go ahead more than 16 years when the EPA sought reimbursement costs in year 2000, and the insured argued this arose from the claim that it had submitted back in 1983 during the policy. The insurer argued that the mere listing at that time of the sites on the National Priorities List were not a claim because they were not a demand for monetary relief. The court closely examined the applicable environmental regulations. It observed that the National Priorities List regulations provide that when a site is placed on the National Priorities List, then EPA will take either enforcement action or clean up and seek response costs. Accordingly, the listing itself was a claim during the policy period, according to the court. The lesson of this case is how important it can be to become proficient in the regulations that surround any governmental action involving the insured. Now, what if a claim is made and reported during the policy period? Can it ever be said that such a claim was untimely reported? Yes, it can be, because almost all claims made forms add a condition requiring timely notice. Some of them require immediate notice. Some require notice as soon as practicable. On slide 12, we see the two types of clauses in most claims made policies that address notice. For clarity's sake, we call the threshold provision right up front, sometimes even on the deck page in a claims made policy, we call that the reporting provision. We call the subsequent provision, found much later in the policy under policy conditions, the notice provision. In a claims made and reported policy, the reporting provision is intended to be a requirement for coverage to exist, whereas the notice provision usually is deemed by courts to be a condition, which, if violated, may support a declination even for a claim that falls within the coverage. Now, there are two common overstatements regarding these provisions that I'm now going to clarify. The first is that failure to satisfy the reporting provision, that's the one right up front that's part of the coverage grant, the first is that failure to satisfy that always bars coverage even if the insurer is not prejudiced. The second common overstatement is that the notice provision, that's the one much later in conditions, never bars coverage unless the insurer demonstrates prejudice. Each of those statements is correct in most states, but not in all, as I will explain. Let's start with the reporting clause. Our first bullet here, we're on slide 13, reflects the insurer's indisputable intent, as well as the holdings in the courts of most states that have considered whether prejudice to the insurer is required in order to enforce the reporting provision. The second bullet concerns four differing states that have considered the question, two of which have concluded that the insurer must demonstrate prejudice. One, Colorado, in which the issue has been certified to the state's court for resolution, plus Kentucky, which has created a test of its own. Each of the first three states enacted a statute at one point. That's the important thing to recognize here. And that those statutes mandated, according to the courts, a showing of prejudice in order for an insurer to prevail on a late notice defense. Now, there can be little doubt that these statutes were aimed at notice conditions in general liability policies, not reporting provisions in claims made policies. And certainly those arguments were made before these courts. Nevertheless, these courts decided that these statutes drew no such distinction, and therefore they imposed a prejudice requirement for claims made policies. Now, in Maryland, we should recognize that that decision is by a federal court predicting state law, and therefore might not be binding on state courts. The Colorado question will be decided by the state's high court, and I will be watching closely for that decision. The Kentucky court has held that a claim made during the expiring policy, but reported during the renewal policy by the same insurer, causes no prejudice to that insurer and thus is covered. So that's a unique rule. There may be some analogs in other states, but Kentucky dealt with it under the analysis of prejudice. So that might make the analysis unique. And again, what they've held is that it is not late notice to even despite what the policy says, to give notice of a claim in the subsequent policy, even when the claim was made to the insured during the expiring policy. Okay. Overstatement number two may equally surprise even folks who have been doing this as long as I have. It is sometimes assumed that the requirement of notice as soon as practicable, found in the conditions section of a claims made policy, is the rough equivalent of a notice condition in a GL policy. However, a Pennsylvania appellate court has held that violation of this provision, like the reporting provision, bars coverage even if the insurer is not prejudiced. Only a few other states have looked at this question, and the other states have ruled prejudice is required. But in Pennsylvania, even if notice is given within the policy period, but not as soon as practicable, then the court may bar coverage. For example, in an annual policy incepting on March 1, a claim made on March 5th, but not reported until September 15th, may be precluded because of late notice, even though it was reported during the policy period. Okay, let's look at an interesting case about reporting under excess claims made policies. The next slide contains a case I litigated a while back in which the excess policy followed form to the primary claims made policy. The excess policy contained no reporting provision of its own. The policyholder timely reported the claim to the primary insurer. The policyholder did not directly report the claim to the excess insurer. I represented the excess insurer, and the policyholder contended that the notice provision, which required notice only to the primary company, had been satisfied, and they mentioned that the excess insurer had seen the claim in a loss run that had been provided during the policy period. The court agreed with us, holding that even though the excess policy was pure follow form, the notice provision had to be interpreted to require specific notice to the excess insurer. So this is an issue you've probably considered or run across before, and it has been answered. All right. Let's move on now and talk about another time-based provision, the retroactive date. Slide 16 shows typical language for a retroactive date clause. The purpose of the retroactive date is to establish a cutoff date in the past so that older acts or omissions cannot result in a current covered claim under the policy. The insured need not know of or even have suspected the existence of its prior negligence in order for the retro date to bar coverage. Look in the declarations as well as in the endorsements to find the retro date or dates. There may be more than one retro date. There may be one retro date for miscellaneous professional liability and another for privacy liability coverage. Also, for insureds that have multiple subsidiaries, you should look for separate retroactive dates for each subsidiary. That's not always the case, but it is particularly among larger and more sophisticated policyholders. I know that it's a soft market when I see retro dates that are the same date that the subsidiary was acquired by the insured. Now, the retro date is a very important provision, but it's hardly ever discussed in educational programs. So let's discuss an important legal issue that I've seen arise several times in connection with the retro date, the question of continuing harm. Slide 18 shows the chronology from one case. Note that the negligence predated the retro date, whereas injuries occurred both before and after the retro date. The insured argued that since injury postdated the retro date and the ultimate claim was first made during the policy period, coverage should exist. Was this a valid argument? No. The court correctly observed, as have other courts, that a continuing tort does not obviate the retro date. Here's what's important to understand. The retro date is not geared to injury. It is geared to the timing of the error or omission. Accordingly, injury that continues or which postdates the retro date is irrelevant. Let me repeat that. Injury that continues or which postdates the retro date is irrelevant. Also, a continuing omission by the insured cannot obviate the retro date, as the court pointed out. Now, the retro date addresses events that occurred many years prior to the policy period. What about claims postdating the policy period? For those, we look to the extended reporting period. There are both automatic and non-automatic extended reporting periods. Automatic periods are typically shorter and become effective if the insurer decides not to renew the policy. Non-automatic ERPs often require the insured to pay some additional premium for the extended coverage. Both forms of ERP usually, though not always, apply only if the coverage is non-renewed. Moreover, modern forms often require that the wrongful act have preceded the regular date of termination of the policy. So, a claim made during the ERP arising from a wrongful act during the ERP would not be covered under most of these forms. Okay, now I'd like to turn to two time-based exclusions that have some similarities but have important distinctions, the prior pending and the prior knowledge exclusions. Slide 21 shows us typical wording for the prior pending exclusion. The focus is on a comparison between a proceeding that began prior to the policy period and the claim during the policy period. The terms pending and prior now mean different things. A pending proceeding is one that is still going forward. A prior proceeding might have terminated, but it still counts for purposes of this clause. Most prior pending clauses look to whether the prior or pending proceedings involved a common fact, circumstance, or transaction with the current claim. So, a prior complaint alleging an antitrust conspiracy to harm the insured's competitor likely will trigger the prior pending exclusion if a new claim is made regarding the same scheme. The bracketed term at the bottom, continuity date, is industry nomenclature. You rarely find this term employed in court opinions. Continuity date refers to the date prior to which commencement of a proceeding will trigger the exclusion. Let me repeat that. Continuity date refers to the date prior to which commencement of a proceeding will trigger the exclusion. There are several methods we see in policies for setting the continuity date. If the continuity date is not set forth in the declarations, then it probably is defined within the exclusion itself. The most common version sets the continuity date as the inception date of the first policy of which the current policy is a continuous renewal or replacement. Now, some underwriters will tell you that a replacement by the same insurer arises only when there is a cancel and rewrite, so it's not the same thing as a renewal. The continuity date can lead to disputes when, for example, the insured asserts that the insurer issued a different kind of policy, maybe a GL policy or an excess policy at a very early date, and argues that this earlier policy sets the continuity date. In a recent case, I persuaded the judge that the continuity date began with the first primary E&O policy issued by my client and not with an excess E&O policy the client had issued the year before. This was crucial because the prior proceeding in that case postdated the earliest policy, which was the excess policy. I succeeded by directing the court to the policy applications. The original application was issued only for the first primary policy, and the first renewal application was issued the next year. Therefore, the court agreed that the first primary policy was not itself a renewal of any policy. That defeated a $20 million claim. Now, some have assumed that the prior proceeding needs to have been known to the insured prior to the continuity date. This is not necessarily so. In a case I recently handled, cited under the second bullet, the underlying claim was a False Claims Act complaint filed under seal and allegedly not made known at that time to the insured. The insured contended that it was unfair and made the coverage illusory to bar coverage where they hadn't known of the prior proceeding. I explained two things to the judge during oral argument, which persuaded him. First, I pointed out that some claims-made policy provisions simply bar coverage because an event originated too long ago. The retro dates, which require no prior knowledge, are a good example. Second, I pointed him to the prior knowledge exclusion, which in that policy sat just an inch above the prior pending exclusion. Now, the prior knowledge exclusion expressly requires prior knowledge by the insured, whereas the prior pending exclusion omits such a requirement, at least under most traditional forms. So that was a pretty compelling argument that the prior pending exclusion does not require prior knowledge. A prior or pending proceeding often is a civil action, but many forms of exclusion apply also to other proceedings. Typical examples of regulatory investigations include environmental, equal employment, Consumer Protection Department complaints, and Department of Labor inquiries. Administrative investigations refer to governmental agencies such as the FDA, the Office of the Inspector General, Health and Human Services, the FBI, etc. Criminal investigations are conducted by the Department of Justice, U.S. Attorney's Office on the federal level, and by state attorneys general's offices on the state level. The Office of the Inspector General, the FBI, and other federal agencies also may undertake or coordinate in federal investigations. You can find out when these investigations began by serving a Freedom of Information Act request on the agency, asking for a document called the Opening Investigative Memorandum. That document will either mark commencement of the investigation or tell you when it began. Now, to have the best chance of seeing the prior pending exclusion applied, an insurer would want to be best informed about what all of the facts are rather than merely stating that the insured is a defendant in both actions. Policyholders contend that if a single common fact such as that bars coverage, then the policy coverage is illusory. So, the case for applying the exclusion is strongest if the facts in common are relatively central and not peripheral. Two cases involving the same botched medical procedure by a doctor are far more likely to trigger the exclusion than two cases that merely involve the same hospital ward. The case for applying the exclusion is very strong if the same plaintiff is involved in both cases, though that is not a required element. If the commonality of facts is sufficient, the exclusion may apply even if the legal theories differ, but a common legal theory can help persuade a court the exclusion should apply. Okay, now I alluded to the prior knowledge exclusion a moment ago, so let's take a look at that exclusion. So we see here the focus clearly is on, one, a prior wrongful act, and two, on knowledge of that act. The inquiry under this exclusion, and under the law of almost all states that have considered it, has a subjective step and an objective step. Subjective means we ask what the insured actually knew, not what it should have known. The brokers on our call today will like this part of the program, and it means that if there was misconduct the insured should have known about but didn't, most forms of this exclusion won't apply. Now let's consider a legal E&O claim where the insured is an attorney who knows she filed a complaint for her client too late and the statute of limitations expired. Is the exclusion triggered? Only if this knowledge would lead an ordinary attorney, and this is the objective test, to recognize that it faced a reasonable possibility this would result in a claim. Now, the courts have made this a pretty low threshold. The case I just described is very common, and the courts have all held that a reasonable attorney who knows he blew the statute of limitations will be deemed to understand there is a reasonable chance he will be sued. This is so even if the attorney might subjectively think that this particular client would never sue him. The analysis focuses on the nature of the error. If it is the kind of error that not uncommonly leads to claims, then the exclusion applies. Nevertheless, we haven't discussed whose knowledge matters. Most current generation exclusions narrow the set of responsible persons, or you might see this in an endorsement, and they narrow it whose knowledge counts to a specified group. It frequently includes all directors and officers, which conceptually includes every vice president. However, insureds sometimes argue that officers really only means persons with the title of executive VP. So disputes arise even when a vice president had prior knowledge. Anyone in the insured's risk management or legal department should qualify. Now, some insureds, I should note, have internal procedures mandating that incoming claims be seen only by attorneys. And then when the insurer inquires about who had knowledge and when, the insured asserts privilege, thus seeking to defeat the exclusion. My argument is that the insured cannot assert privilege to prevent inquiry to find out if the exclusion applies. Okay, so we've looked at the retro date, the claim first made question, claim reporting, and the prior pending and prior knowledge exclusions. Let's see how we might look at all of these issues in a single claim. We have a hypothetical claim timeline on slide 29. The civil complaint here was first filed during the policy period. So let's assume the insured asserts the claim was first made during the policy period. Now let's see how many issues we can spot. I'd start with the date of the wrongful act itself. If that wrongful act preceded the retro date, then there's no coverage even if the claim was first made during the policy period. Now, what if no injury occurred until after the retro date? Coverage is still precluded under most policy forms because the retro date is keyed to the date of the wrongful act, an error or omission, and not the date of harm to the claimant. Next, I'd seek to find out when the insured first learned that it had committed a wrongful act. That often depends on the nature of the wrongful act. If an insured doctor knew he amputated the wrong leg, then the knowledge is coincident with the act. If an insured doctor negligently left a sponge in a body cavity without realizing it, the knowledge might not arise until the insured receives a letter complaining of the doctor's treatment. Such a letter, which is shown in the second point from the left on our timeline, will implicate the prior knowledge exclusion if it was received prior to the continuity date. If the continuity date clause is keyed to the first E&O policy shown on our graph here, then the prior knowledge exclusion clearly is in play. The letter to the insured also likely will constitute a claim made prior to the policy period if it reflects that the claimant is or threatens to seek monetary relief. That is usually a simpler analysis than the prior knowledge exclusion, so an insurer may primarily invoke that ground as placing the claim outside coverage. Next, I would consider whether the complaint filed during the policy period was preceded by any other civil or regulatory proceeding. Sometimes the complaint will reference such a prior proceeding, but most times one needs to do a bit of searching, which I'll cover if time permits. If, for example, a complaint had been made to an insurance department which was investigating it, that might trigger the prior pending exclusion. So we consider whether some investigation or proceeding commenced in advance of the filing of the complaint to determine whether the prior pending exclusion applies. Now, in our example here, note that the inception of the insurer's first policy is the benchmark for the continuity date. If that is the benchmark for the continuity date, then an investigation commencing subsequently will not trigger the exclusion. Next, I would confirm that the complaint filed during the policy period contains a demand for monetary damages and otherwise triggers coverage insofar as that is a requirement for it to constitute a claim. Then we must determine if this claim was reported during the policy period. Here it was not, but it was reported prior to expiration of the extended reporting period. If the ERP was purchased or applies automatically, then the claims made requirement likely is satisfied. The claim reported requirement likely is satisfied. Now, if we were to change the facts a bit, and the insured's error occurred during the ERP, then the ERP likely would not save coverage. Most forms of ERPs only apply to errors that occur prior to the regular expiration date of the policy. Next, I would consider whether the delay of at least 6 months or so, as seems here, in providing notice of the claim runs afoul of the notice provision under the conditions section of the policy. So, we can see that there are a host of time-related issues that arise from any moderately complex claim scenario. The following partial decision tree provides a sense of the complexity of the analysis. Note that these steps will vary depending on the policy terms. Some policy forms don't require that the claim be reported during the policy period, for example. So now that we've enumerated the issues, how do we learn the facts? There are a number of tools that are increasingly useful as one grows in proficiency. These are some of the ones that I favor. I like to read 10Ks on my lunch hour, and you can find quite a bit about a company you might want to invest in, but you will also find a statutorily required discussion of pending litigation and much of the threatened litigation against the company, which may be an insured, for example. Oh, let me cover SEC filings first. Just as a broad overview, 10-Ks are the annual statement that a publicly traded company is required to file each year and should list all material litigation against the company. And often you'll see historical data there as well. 10-Qs are the quarterly reports that update on material developments during the preceding 90 days. 8-Ks are reports of material events, and those are ad hoc but must be filed promptly upon the occurrence of a material event, such as a major lawsuit. 8-Ks in particular are a fertile source of information regarding prior proceedings against the insured, because you can go back 10 years or more on the internet and find those. Okay, here's an actual 10-K from a few years back. The highlighted terms are ones I would take note of. Look how we learn here about the insured's loss control and claim recognition methodologies. We can also learn about pre-suit investigations. This is a continuation, and look at the bottom on slide 34. The insured learned in 2007 of an action against it. Then in January 2009, it received a courtesy copy of the complaint. Now, that's a claim, according to nearly every definition. So I've learned important information just by accessing public information during my lunch hour. For non-publicly traded companies, sources of information continue to proliferate. Justia is a public database that reports on virtually every lawsuit that is filed in a federal court. It's free to learn who has been sued and when through Justia. To obtain a copy of the docket or a pleading involves a small charge. PACER is the name the federal courts use for their online docketing system. I found it to be more inclusive than Justia, but it helps to know the jurisdiction in which to search. Westlaw and Lexis are fee-based services. They will tell you about reported decisions, and they can be useful for locating older state court filings. In addition, an increasing number of state courts are now searchable by party name, state court dockets, and that's very effective if you can narrow down the jurisdictions in which to search. These are some more sources that you can use. Yahoo Finance message boards, it might be the only part of Yahoo that is still thriving relative to its former prominence. You can find out an awful lot of both dubious and credible information there about what people are saying about the company and what problems it faces and has faced in the recent past. Google searches have all sorts of levels of depth that you can drill into, and I certainly recommend becoming as proficient as possible. You can set it so that you're only searching, for example, for items that appeared between 2010 and 2013. Government websites are a source of great information. I'll talk about that in a little bit because almost all of the agencies now publish updates on what they're investigating, who they're investigating, and when they were, insofar as those investigations are no longer confidential. Freedom of Information Act requests are extremely valuable. They have a bad reputation, but only for one reason. They are extremely slow. You can count on having to wait about a year at least after you've made a request to get the information. You'll hear back in days, if not in a week or so, and they're statutorily required to get back to you very quickly, and they will. But the information may take a year or more to get there. But you will get it, and you may be surprised at how much you can learn. The main issue is you've got to make the request early, but it costs nothing to make the request. So it's something I undertake early, particularly in my larger cases. Here's a posting. I was talking a little bit earlier about government websites. This is a posting by the Antitrust Division of DOJ on slide 37. Toward the bottom, it notes that the government was investigating Google and Yahoo in 2008. Well, if you have a prior pending exclusion that includes administrative investigations, you want to know this. Again, there's a lot of case law out there that says that any federal agency or state agency is essentially administrative. So that's what one is concerned about if you have the administrative investigation clause in a prior proceedings exclusion. The U.S. Attorney's Office, for example, is an agency of the Justice Department, and therefore an investigation by the U.S. Attorney's Office is an administrative investigation, according to most courts. Now, the insurer's main conduit for information is the insured, and an insurer has the right to request information from the insured regarding events pertaining to the claim, including prior events. These are some of the major categories or heads of things that are addressed in a reservation of rights letter with information request. I've left out the coverage issues. That's a little bit beyond the scope of this presentation. But let me talk a little bit about the issue of valid tender, because it's not often addressed. If the insured has not requested the insurer to defend it, or if the insured has made no showing that the claim arose during the policy period, then in many cases, the insurer may not be in a position to defend, even if there would otherwise be coverage. It is incumbent on the insured to demonstrate that the claim was first made during the policy period, assuming that the policy language so requires. Accordingly, in appropriate cases, an insurer may begin by politely noting that it has not been provided with facts showing that a claim was made during the policy period. And this is important. This is not advice to be terribly aggressive or anything like that. The point is that there have been instances of insurers being a little too quick on the trigger to appoint defense counsel and the policyholder saying, wait a second, I never wanted that. So it's good practice at the very beginning to ask that question and make sure that's what's being requested and that threshold has been crossed. It may also be important because if it hasn't happened, then doctrines of waiver and estoppel that some courts will apply don't arise yet. Until there's been a tender, a lot of courts will say that the insurer cannot waive or be estopped from asserting any defenses later. Let me talk about the detailed information request. These are some of the broad categories of information that I think good practice typically involves, again, depending upon the circumstances of the claim and the terms of the policy. The fourth point here sometimes is missed. Remember that the prior knowledge exclusion may be contingent upon knowledge held by a narrowly defined set of high-level individuals. This may be further modified in an endorsement buried deep in 24 or more endorsements. Find out whose knowledge is relevant. Is it the CEOs only? Is it the directors and officers only? Is it the risk management department and so forth? Or is it more general? And the insurer can then tailor its inquiries to learn, when necessary, who these folks are and what knowledge they acquired and when. The point is, if that can be done in an early letter, it saves some time and steps in having subsequent letters to ask that type of a question. Let me conclude with a few thoughts, and we're going to have at least 5 minutes for questions and answers. I hope that I've conveyed that our understanding of insurance coverage should never stagnate. Our knowledge should continue to evolve, and we should always be looking for best practices as they emerge, always be looking at what's being done in the industry and keeping current on what we need to do to be the best at addressing claims and adjudicating them promptly and fairly and accurately under the law and under the policy. Unwarranted assumptions, for example, and this is equally a problem for policyholders and brokers as for insurers, such as the misconception that no state requires prejudice under claims made policies, that can lead to problems. So it's terribly important to stop and consider the local law that could apply, and again, to look over the policy and make sure it's been read all the way through. Also, we must strive to master the regulatory environment in which our insureds do business with respect to particular claims, not with respect to other claims, but those that come from a regulatory milieu. It's very important to understand what the regulatory provisions that surround it, just like we saw in the RSR case where the court looked into what it meant to be on the national priorities list. That can be extremely helpful and crucial to recognize when an action is a claim and when it isn't. In addition, we need to learn how to mine public sources, such as Freedom of Information Act requests, to find out what may have preceded a particular claim. And finally, because it can never be repeated enough, read every endorsement in the policy. Thank you. We do have a few minutes remaining, and I'm happy to address a few questions. If I do not have time to get to every question, I want you to know that your questions are important. So all the questions will come to me by email. They'll be anonymous. I'm not going to read out anybody's name as I respond here, but I can respond directly to you if I don't have time to get to your question. So, first question I've got, and I'll read it out to you. How does one determine whether a duty to defend has arisen when the evidence is uncertain regarding when the claim was first made? Okay, good question. Well, the insurer rarely will be able to determine when the claim was first made simply by examining a complaint against the insured. The complaint itself may be a claim, but it may not tell us when the claim was first made. It also likely will not contain any allegation shedding light on that. So even if the plaintiff sent a demand letter to the insured a year earlier, there's usually no reason to allege that fact in the complaint. So you're not going to see it in there. It's a very different duty to defend analysis here, if you could even call it that, compared to the duty to defend analysis under a GL policy. So the insurer often, therefore, has to depend on extrinsic facts obtainable primarily from the insured and sometimes from public sources, as we've discussed. I think this dynamic has led a lot of courts to conclude that no duty to defend really arises, even when the underlying complaint alleges facts that otherwise would trigger coverage, but where there's a question as to whether that's the claim that was first made, because that's extrinsic to the four corners of the underlying complaint. That's an important issue, and the question about whether the duty to defend is triggered in terms of the claims made is a topic for another seminar. But typically, it does require resort to extrinsic evidence. Okay, next question. Is a request to enter into a tolling agreement considered a claim? Without more, most states would say no. The tolling agreement in itself would have to say one of two things. It would have to say that it relates to a current demand for damages, or it has to make relate to a palpable threat for damages. So I think the majority of courts would want to see that much. There are tolling agreements that I've been familiar with that simply relate to somebody holding off on an action against our policyholder, but they're not really seeking damages. They might, for example, be seeking equitable or injunctive relief, and that type of relief might not trigger coverage under the policy. Here's another. Let's see. Is a letter notifying of a construction defect pursuant to a statute, does that qualify as a claim, such as the Calderon process in California? More likely than not, it will. And again, you'll see my small disclaimer at the top of these slides, but more likely than not, it will, because of the sort of formalized process that we're talking about here. It's different when you have a relationship between the parties that is, for example, if you have an owner and a general contractor, or a general contractor and a sub, and they're in an environment involving change orders and punch lists and construction defect, and the party who's in this ongoing contractual relationship is simply saying, you're not doing a good enough job, do better. Those types of instances are rarely going to be regarded as a claim. On the other hand, I think if you have a party that is outside normal privity with the offending party, with the insured, or if this is sort of a one-off instance, then I think it's far more likely to be regarded as a claim, because in that instance, the remedy of the claimant is going to typically be for monetary relief rather than saying, no, simply, you know, we're on an ongoing relationship and you have to improve your work. Let's see. Here's another one. ISO publishes EPLI policy forms that define claim, and that definition includes alleging that the insured is responsible for damages. Damages mean monetary damages. What are the considerations for an analysis on an EEOC charge of discrimination notification to an employer as to it meeting the requirement for damages within that of the claim, within that, I assume it means within that definition of claim? The EEOC notifications generally do not state any monetary amounts being sought. I agree. The courts are split on this issue. I'm going to give you one citation. There's an EEOC case in Pennsylvania. Actually, I'll have to provide that after this, but there is a case where the court dealt with that directly. And that particular charge, the court concluded, did represent damages. There are many decisions going the other way. So that is one on which the courts are split. We are out of time at this point. There are a number of other questions that I will address personally because I have them all here. I want to thank you all very much. I hope you learned a lot, and I wish you good luck in the years to come.
Thank you for joining us today for the webinar, Time-Based Defenses Under E&O Policies. We hope you found today's program to be informative and educational. The five-digit CLE code for today is 18390. Once again, the CLE code for today is 18390. Please watch for any upcoming webinars from our Global Insurance Department. Thank you again. This concludes today's webinar. Goodbye.